Nein, er left.
Okay, I believe we're live.
Oh, we
Live
are.
here. Yeah.
Well,
Okay.
hello, Vance. How are you?
I'm just fine. Good to see you. This
It's
is
great to speak with you too.
I can't be getting an echo. It's just the two of us. So it should be okay. Anyway, this is Sunday, and on if it's Sunday, it must be learning together, which it is. It's we're a little early today, well, from what we normally are, because Alex is in Australia, in Canberra, and it's 9 o'clock in the evening where he is right now, and he has family, so he doesn't want to be up too late. Normally we start about noon GMT, which is, not noon, about 1400, which is about 3 hours from now, so a lot of our normal audience might have been caught off guard. But we did have Jorge Hedayate here a moment ago. Maybe she'll come back. But this is the 18th of May. And there's my cat. My cat just said hi. There he is. Okay. Let's get in the picture.
Hi,
and,
cat.
Yeah. Let's get him a set of headphones.
He's having a good look around.
He's going to do something rather embarrassing in a moment, I'm sure.
He's looking for something to eat.
Ah, there we go. Okay. So, anyhow, Alexander is, do you like to be called Alex or Alexander in your videos, in your professional
look,
life?
It's interesting one, Vance. I think as I've become more published, people are starting to call me Alexander, believe it or not. But I used to be called Alex a lot, but I now get called Alexander. I don't mind, really. My name is Alexander. I don't have a middle name, so I'm Alexander.
Okay. My middle name is Vance, believe it or not. So my first name is Glenn. I think it's confusing for some people.
It does. My mother uses her middle name, yeah.
Yeah, well, anyhow, gosh, I think I first became aware of you through Barbara Dew, probably, back when
yes.
You guys did your network learning thing in, what did you call it, learning in a network world?
Yes, learning in a networked world, teach and learn online, the future of learning in a networked world.
That was it.
And it was 2005. With murmurings in 2004, so it's about 2005.
We sort of interacted now and then. Michael Coughlin has been I got to know him last century, and then we've been online compatriots. And so then I think the next thing that came across my radar was Streamfolio, and
yes,
you came online and talked to us about Streamfolio in one of my multi-literacy courses. So
that's right.
Well, tell us just a little bit about Streamfolio, because that was one of your first. It was a commercial project, obviously, but was that a first foray in business?
No, it wasn't the first foray in business. I've been in business ever since I was a teenager, but it was the first time that I had collectively. Assembled and was interrogating, I suppose, in a way, this idea that humans have the ability to impart knowledge if they can be hands-free, they can be unencumbered within their activity, and that they can be recording and annotating what it is that they are recording. So it was the first... It was very unpopular. in terms of, we were way ahead of the time, I think, in terms of a commercial context. So we really were probably in 2007, 2006, seen as absolute loopies. But by 2009, we got wind that we had many followers from the military, from community policing, from trades, from a whole heap of people. So we decided we'd call together a symposium, and we had over 100 people attend, which was quite remarkable. And so point of view video was very apparent at that time. And I started to learn about, back in 2006, 2007, I learned about Professor Steve Mann in Toronto, Thad Starner from MIT, and a few others. And really, we didn't seem that odd when we compared ourselves to the perceptual computing group. But what we did know at the time was that Streamfolio needed to be there because it was really about the data. It was really about, it's all well and good to record something, but where are you going to put all this video? And most people would not have any capability to put it up in their organization. We discovered that was the case. It still is the case in a lot of cases. But there are many other services now where you can have a private video channel. So we were essentially exploring first-person perspective video, making that into learning resources, and connecting, networking people together who are interested in that type of behavior as well. Hi, yeah. David.
Yeah, this is David Wexler in New Jersey. I believe that's probably where you are on a Sunday morning. Am I right? Yeah. Okay, yep, must be. Well, anyway, okay, yes. So getting back to This Is Your Life, that POV conference I think you mentioned was one of the another thing that I followed via its podcast format. I was really fascinated with a lot. I think that's the one where the Michaels were both there, and they were talking about what you call sous-valence. I guess I think it's French sous-valence, but uber-valence, things like that. All these. Well, I thought that was that conference was quite interesting because it had a lot of people. You know, talking from the VTE sector about how they're showing people welding with whatever point of view device that they had, you know, maybe a forehead thing or something like that. And it showed a lot of affordances of POV technology in education. And then it also kind of explored some of the undercurrents that you're quite into with GLASS, which is the Steve Mann undercurrents, you know, the sous-valence or sous-valence, which he coined, for example. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how those threads kind of took off at about that point.
Well, I should give this some time because it's a story that's largely untold. At the AUPOV conference, I'd been talking with Jeff, my partner, commercial partner, business partner, that I felt that at some point that surely these manufacturers would introduce these devices being internet connected. We sat there musing. We were up actually with Bill Wade up at Mobilize This up in Darwin, Northern Territory. Which is it's quite a remote area of Australia. Beautiful city, but very small. And we were thinking and talking about Thad Starner and we were talking about the MIT group, and we wondered as to how long it would be before we would see a corporation start to harness heads-up displays and network connection, and not only network connection, but even then we were talking about neuroscience, thinking about things and changing things just by thinking. And I met Katina Michael, who is my supervisor through the University of Wollongong. I'm doing a PhD through that university. I was introduced to Professor Roger Clark, who coined the term data valence back 22 years ago in Australia, who was very much against the Australia card tagging and identifying individuals by always having to have a card on you. Seems farcical these days. And Katina introduced me she threw me in the deep end almost immediately. She said, I have a symposium coming up next week, Alex. I'd like you to speak at it. But firstly, I'd like you to write for me I'd like you to make application for a PhD through the University of Wollongong. And her amazing husband, Michael, Emmanuel Michael, he he encouraged me to write, and I sat at my parents' house for 40 days and 40 nights, and I wrote my heart out. I wrote everything I knew into the one application, and I submitted it. And when they received it, it was close to 60 pages in total, and the remark was, well, if we just get literature review out of the way, we can just submit that. You've done it. But there's a number of things here. A PhD is a long, rigorous journey, and you've just begun that journey. And here are some things to think about. So the following week, I went to a symposium, and I did a presentation very naively, stood up and did a presentation. And it was in the centre of transnational crime prevention, in the middle of Wollongong. It's a building absolutely chock-a-block filled with surveillance cameras. In every single room, in every single part of the building, there is a surveillance camera everywhere you go. And at that meeting, there were roboticists, there were privacy advocates, there were ethicists, there were all sorts of amazing people. And then sitting next to me on my right, there were two people that I thought had got the wrong room. One was a rather robust sort of chap, and it appeared to be his partner. Anyway, I went around the room introducing everybody, and it started with him, and he said, "My name is Amol Garastra. I'm a DIY hobbyist. I was here invited by Katina to fly from Los Angeles to come to this workshop today. I'm very interested to hear what we have to say today." And then he introduced his wife and got around to MG and a few other people. And then Michael said, "But you've introduced yourself, but why are you here?" He said, "Because I'm a DIY hobbyist. I've chipped myself. I have chips in my hands in here. I drive my car is driven by the way that I can interact with my, I don't have keys anymore to my house, the car, to lots of things. I'm choosing to control my world via this ubervalent technology, this embedded technology in my body. I chose to put it in my body." Well, I was just about floored, you know, because I had never really heard about anybody being chipped before. Like, I'd heard it in science fiction, of course, but I'd never actually sat next to somebody. And then I went around the room and we said to his wife, "So, and yourself?" And she remarked, "Well, so am I. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to live within this world of my, you know, what we've created." And that became that was just the beginning of it's been a fairly profound journey for the last 3 years, particularly. I've run international conferences with all of world leaders, including the head of Google. I've interviewed over 100 people under an ethics regime with under the HREC with my university. And as you can see on my lower third there, I'm now a professional associate at a university exploring this in a practical way in an educational and training context. And I've attended Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference in Washington just as the NSA hit in, the whole thing being filmed by Facebook and a hell of a lot of the Homeland Security of the US being there present as well. It's been an interesting journey, backwards and forwards to Finland and the UK and all over the place. So, yeah, that's just a short wrap.
Yeah, that brings us almost up to the present. And, boy, I tell you, this is what makes you a really hard guy to interview. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not that we have to do anything. It just gets you talking. Listen, I'd like to welcome these other people who have arrived.
There's
Nina Liakos, who's joined us, and Teresa Almeida Deja. And Hora is back from Florida.
Hi, Nina.
And, does anybody have any questions for Alex? We're always interactive here.
Vance.
Yes.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Hello, Vance.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, you usually pronounce my name perfectly, but today you made a mistake in the last word. It's not Deja. It's Dessa. Nope. Dessa, like two S's.
Yeah.
Okay,
oh,
yes.
Well done.
Hi, Alex. I'm in Portugal. How are you?
I'm finally glad. I've got most components of Teresa's name down. She's working on me overtime.
Just joking.
You could also just... You could shorten it and just call her Teresa Vaz. Yeah, you got Liakos perfectly today, Vance. The thing is, the longer we let him get away with mispronouncing, the worse it gets. So good, Teresa, you jumped in on the first mistake.
Hey, Nina, good.
Well, we're talking with Alex Hayes, who, as you can see, is a very interesting person. He's been doing some really interesting work. This is fascinating to me. What he's done lately is interviewed Google Glass Explorers. I don't know, has anybody had a chance to listen to any of those interviews? We sort of set a homework assignment for this evening, but you don't have to.
I'm so sorry. I looked at that list at about 11 o'clock last night, and I picked one of the shortest interviews, but I just had to go to sleep. So it's there in my to-do list.
Andy Kropa, did you listen to that one? That would probably be the shortest one.
There were two that were 15 minutes. It might have been Andy Kropa. What was the other one that was short?
I don't know. Which one else?
There were a couple that were so short they're not even up there.
I have a quick question. I noticed that you're not wearing glasses for this interview, and can you wear Google Glass if you don't have glasses to hook it onto? Stupid question, maybe. But I've never seen this device except in pictures.
And neither had I until last Monday. So
really?
Well, no. Sorry, that's not the truth. I hadn't seen it in such a mass of people as last Monday, but we flushed them out last Monday here in Australasia. I flew in from New Zealand to attend this event.
Description.
I'll tell you, this will give you a realistic picture. I ran a conference in Toronto in June last year. So let's think, we're almost hitting a year afterwards. So a year ago, I ran a conference, and as the convener, I stood in the back room looking through an old ancient stone archway in the Great Hall of Toronto University. And standing inside the archway was Marvin Minsky, who is well known as being the father of artificial intelligence. Then we had Professor Steve Mann with his arm around the shoulder of Marvin Minsky, both looking through the doorway at Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of Google and head of Singularity University, on a hangout, one of the first hangouts. But in the audience was a contemporary, Thad Starner, who is the chief architect of Google Glass, looking at Thad, and also, at the time we didn't know, but also controlling what he was hearing and seeing from the audience in the background, like a walking microphone. So the device itself can be worn with prescription lenses. It can be worn with sunglasses. That can be worn as a standalone digital eyewear device without any glass in it at all, that most people are moving towards, and actually a lot of the optometry venues around your country and around others are moving towards Google Glass being sort of integrated or collapsed into your normal eyewear, your normal prescription reading glasses and other. Yeah.
But what if you don't have normal eyewear? What if you don't wear glasses?
Then you don't wear glass.
Okay, that was my question.
But you get a headband.
But how about these chips that you were mentioning? Is there Google Glass in the chips, or is that a different technology?
That's a different technology altogether. Okay. But what I was talking about, it's interesting when we think about these interviews, Vance and others. What I did was I thought of what are the most unpopular questions that you would ask people who are a glass explorer caught up in this whole flurry of, you know, fantastic, it's changed my life sort of stuff. And from an educational, I'm very interested from an educational and social research, you know, the impact side. And so I asked people about who they were, who they were affiliated with, who they were in terms of who they were affiliated with, what sort of occupations they have and so on, what they use the technology for, how they got involved with it, what they think the word privacy means, what sort of impact do they think it's going to have on humanity. And almost all of them, if you listen to them, when I ask questions, I also asked a series of segue questions that came off that, depending on the person and personality. They almost invariably went to where technology trajectory is heading. Most of them indicate that they believe that technology is heading closer and closer to the body, closer and closer to the human, and ultimately is heading inside the human and will be part of the human. And these are everyday people. They're everyday people like you and I and anyone else, but on average, quite a big proportion of them have stated that they believe technology is going to be uber-valent, is going to be a surveillance tool, that's technology that will be embedded into the body.
Well, actually, that's, we're already there without the kinds of technology you're talking about. Anybody that has a pacemaker or some kind of titanium bone, whatever, contact lenses or, you know, getting close. It reminds me of a MOOC I took last year with Dr. Yuval Harari from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem on, it's called A Brief History of Mankind, and the last lecture was on the future of mankind, and he postulated that people will not be human, and that's already begun. Yeah. That we're adding stuff to ourselves to extend our lives, to extend our vision, to enable us to do things that if we didn't do that, we couldn't do those things.
That's right. We're moving towards, as Ray Kurzweil, who heads up Google, says, is the state of singularity. That if you look up cyborg anthropology, you'll find many things about the nature of where we're destined to head, according to any number of different people. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Alex, Vance, can I just pitch in tell Alex that I listened to Kimberly's interview, your interview of Kimberly, and really into that. And then I listened to Stephen Downs, also enjoyed it, and I'm in the middle of Kathy Schrock's interview. Also an interesting perspective, very practical, etc. So I will be listening to more of them.
Fantastic.
Yeah, good, thanks good, to them. Very good.
Teresa, you're a good role model for me. I just listened to the interviews.
I was curious. And one of these days, I think I'll buy some Google glasses.
You can in America. Yes, you can. It's now an open beta, which to us signals something very different to what it would signal to other people. Last week I went to a Prime Minister and Cabinet meeting with the Australian Government. I was asked to do a three-hour briefing with the ministerial advisers prior to the meeting to explain what glass was, saying, well, this is a bone-conducting microphone that listens through the back of your eardrum. This is a camera that actually looks at your retina and your eye. This one here is a light meter microphone. This is a GPS. This has got a multiplicity of cameras, all the rest of it. Essentially, it's a smartphone for your head. They indicated that they wanted me in the workshop that afternoon, which I did, was to take this glass out of its case, satchel thing, and put it on the table in the middle of the room, but don't say anything about it. Just let it be there, and the people in the room react to it. Well, it got ignored for the first couple of minutes, but then after a period of time, people recognized that it was something. It changed the whole room. The whole became a whole room conversation with 80 people, and the whole conversation was around the state-society relationship between government and corporation. The change in the ability of governments to actually deal with data and deal with privacy and deal with law and deal with jurisdiction and sovereignty, and how things are changing as a result of these ubiquitous technologies which have a auto backup chain back to the source of the provider. So when Glass went beta this week, it's actually signalled that much of the Australian Law Reform Commission and the US Senate, who have grave concerns about what the device may or may not do in the future and in the present, as to its proliferation, its ubiquity, its likelihood to shift humanity in certain ways, because it will be impossible for us to say to a learner or to another fellow colleague in our work setting, excuse me, I object to you wearing that technology. I wish for you to take the technology off, and I do not want that technology in my presence. We will not be able to say that. It's not my concern at all. What I'm doing is trying to unearth what the complexities of human relationship are going to be and the impact that will occur as a result of what looks to be a global rollout of a head-worn, always-on, or standby mode device. That's a very clever device. It's a very clever nascent technology. So, it is available. Yes, you can buy it in the United States.
Several of my impressions listening to those really fascinating interviews is that kind of conversation, that thing that you said, where people would be concerned that someone is wearing it, seems to be dealt with quite a lot in the conversations you recorded. And somebody I was listening to today, I can't remember who it was off the top of my head, but she made the point that this thing has a 45-minute battery life, and she's not going to waste her time taking pictures of people who don't mean anything to her, which is to say, just like anything else that you've ever carried, whether it be a Polaroid camera, you're not just taking pictures because you're going to run out of film and it's expensive, or if you're taking pictures on your cell phone, you've got a limited memory in there, which is expanding. And whatever you're using, it just doesn't work that way. You don't just record everything, except life loggers, people who might chip themselves or whatever, or might be recording everything for kind of different reasons. And there are people who do that, like Steve Mann, for example, is a well-known one. The idea, I think, is that it changes the... A lot of people talked also about the change in perspective, that everything is going through the eyes, and therefore you don't have to look away. Like, it's safer to drive, for example. You can think of lots of things that you do in your daily life that you have to dig out your mobile phone and answer it, and here, just Glass, answer that for me or whatever, you know, read that to me. So people talk about how they can do things from their own point of view seamlessly, and that works in, I mean, obviously with doctors and lawyers and people in professions. There was a truck driver who was one of the people that he interviewed, teachers, because, you know, you can be getting data on what students are actually doing, or you can put, I think that same lady that was saying that you put that, you could have that in a class where someone was absent or someone was unable to come to class due to a condition, and that person could direct someone else in the room to show him or her this or that. That's two of the three things that really came out at me. The third thing is that if you take your idea of people, let's say you've seen pictures of people in Japan probably all sitting around a table and all looking down their mobile phones texting one another. Okay? Now, if they're using glass, they're looking at one another. And that came up quite a lot. People who wear glass get interacted with a lot. People who commute with them, people, it's not an isolated journey on the bus anymore. People are talking to them. And so they're actually bringing people out. Now you think not of the people in the, around the table texting like this, but they want to do that. Well, now they're texting like this, you know, and they're actually conversing and talking to one another. I think Alex asked a lot of people how this took place in their home life, and there was one couple who both had glass. Alex, you might want to take it from there.
Yeah. Lance, can I interrupt, make a comment, just a humorous one before you say something? You know, I also remember that part about the texting, everybody looking down, et cetera, and so on, in one of the interviews. And that reminded me of an email message I got the other day from a friend with this old-fashioned small blackboard in a coffee shop here in somewhere in Portugal. And it said, "We don't have Wi-Fi. Talk to one another." And I thought that was fabulous. With lots of spelling mistakes, etc. But anyway, it was really fabulous.
Well, you've got to get a photo of that. I'd love a photo.
I'll send it to you. Yeah, I will. Okay.
There is a photo. Yeah, I got it in one of those, you know, ubiquitous emails that people send you of pictures of weird things.
I'd love to see one. On that note, it's interesting because I'm also interested in the historical narrative of the way that we socialize and also in a sort of technocratic way, how these technologies fit within the diffusion of innovations. I mean, glass is really just the second loop of mobile phones. We're all normal, like, I don't know anyone except children who don't have a mobile phone. And many of those phones are smartphones. So glass, in actual fact, piggybacks on top of the phone because it just makes the phone a dumb terminal. The phone, no longer, the screen's not needed anymore. So you put the phone back in your pocket, it's using the phone as a router. So your phone has essentially just become a router. And that's all it will be in the future. And in the very near future, not in 6 months. So the phone screen will gradually not be needed. Siri, the actual voice command, is incredibly astute now. It can do some amazing things. But when I ask these people questions like, what do you do in your home life, Kimberly, before you actually put the glass on your head, there was no photos or videos of your children wearing swimsuits or the naked children in the bath in your YouTube channel. What does it mean to you now? And why is it that your 14-year-old child thinks you're a freak, or, you know, is freaked out by you being near them when you're wearing the glass? Like, and that's no disrespect to the individual. Don't get me wrong here. I interviewed people and humans. I interviewed humans about the way that technology is impacting on their lives. I didn't interview them about Google Glass per se. I interviewed them about a diffusion of what is a 25-year-old project. This project is not a new project. It's a Google X. It's had tens of millions of dollars thrown at it. And that tens of millions of dollars is starting to see fruit because Google is an identity violent engine. It loves matter. It loves to be able to use visual facial recognition. It uses voice recognition, triangulates things by geoposition. It serves information to people according to all of that, and all of it, it's been time and time again. It's not about, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's actually a very, very acutely engineered piece of social inclusion that will affect a lot of people. So when I ask the questions, as Vance was saying, in a family setting, most people said, I said to them, well, you can go back and check. I should actually do a cross chart of what I said and where, what questions I asked and what was the response. But the predominant one around privacy was when I said, what does the term privacy mean to you? Most people said, privacy is a metaphorical object that is at the front of the house. It's got three hinges on it and a door handle.
Hmm.
It's called the front door. It's become an object. Privacy is the object at the front door. Privacy is no longer present in public space. There's no such thing as privacy in public space. And the other thing was that when I asked some people that were very critically minded, Randall Leverett, Nicholas Starr, people like that, they did some fascinating stuff off camera. Luckily, I didn't press the button on that. But when I did interview them and asked them about the difference between privacy and transparency, that's when the conversation really started. The majority of where we're heading has got nothing to do with privacy. It's to do with transparency, because of none of us have got anything to hide. None of us. None of us have any concern with a corporation having our data whatsoever. None of us. It's okay for us and them to have all of us and them. It actually makes us who we are. And we are cyborgs. That's according to their perspective. That's how they see it. They say don't talk to me about privacy. If you want to talk to me about transparency and where we're heading, then that conversation began 10 years ago. All the privacy stuff is finished. Forget it. All over Red Rover. So, yeah.
That's kind of scary.
It is. It is.
Stephen Downs mentioned something he'd read. I actually looked it up in the Canadian newspapers, but someone in the government there said it's not a. He said Canadians would accept the government monitoring them. It's hiding that fact that they would not accept, and which is exactly what the U.S. government has done. They're anything but transparent. If you read about data, everything is being monitored, and sometimes for good reason. You like it, if it's telling you what you purchase in just a couple of minutes. You don't have to waste a lot of time. It just tells you what you want.
My favorite example of non-transparent is Apple. I read Steve Jobs' biography, and the way he insisted on having all Apple devices unopenable because he didn't want anybody to see inside or fiddle around with what was inside Apple devices.
Sure. But as a corporation, they knew that people, the only way that they actually invented new things was for people to pull them apart and provide them with information to do that. It was a conglomerate of people actually hacking it that gave them the best information to develop. I was interested, somebody said earlier in a point there about that really defining transparency is going to be part of our responsibility as educators, I think. We struggle, we're really in a flux moment, I think. I've mentioned this a number of times, and I wrote an article called Cyborg Cops. It was about 2 years or 3 years ago, where I experienced a very unusual thing here in Australia where we didn't have ANPR cameras like they are in other parts of the world. And I drove into McDonald's, I was very late at night, very tired, trying to get home. I live 30 kilometres away from the city. Got myself a coffee, something to eat, pulled out of the driveway, and a police officer pulled me over and said, how's your trip been? And I said, excuse me, he said, you're driving your trip. I said, well, I'm tired. He said, we haven't got far to go. And I said, no, I don't. And I said, how do you know where I'm going? And he said, well, I'm just reading here. I'm reading on my heads-up display here. This is a device that tells me that we've scanned your plates on your car, we have information, and we're talking to you about where you're going.
Oh, my.
Uh-huh. And I thought, okay, so now they have where I'm going, who I'm going, how far I've got to go. They've basically got everything that they need. So if I had said anything out of turn, I would have just been in incrimination land. Anyway, mm-hmm. The moral to the story is that the device which is sold as a fashionista device is actually a very powerful tool. It's a very powerful tool, and we're going to have to find a middle ground somewhere in there. We've got to find a middle ground, because the first questions I asked Kathy Schrock, it was rather naughty of me, but I said to her, very first question, Kathy, can you tell me what the difference is between a educational technologist and a brand evangelist? Well, Kathy proceeded to tell me that she's a Google certified educator. So we just kept on going on with the conversation right through. Now, Kathy is a very respected educator who's done some amazing trials with Glass in Class, and is coming to Australia to provide us with an insight into how she's used them with middle primary children in extended time settings, and also Margaret Powers, who I also interviewed, who's been using them with early childhood children and parents and teachers for extended periods of time inside educational classrooms. So if you haven't yet heard of Glass, don't know what it looks like, are probably astounded by what I'm just saying at the moment, then I really, really urge you to go and have a good look at what's actually happening in this space, because it's moving fast. It's not going backwards. It's accelerating. Exponential rate of return is just incredible. So last Monday we had an event here, and yeah, we unearthed. I had no idea it was happening, Vance, before last Monday. But into the setting there at the university, in came 10 students from Canberra Grammar School, all boys school, sons of diplomats here in and other professional people, and most of those kids were wearing Glass and have been building apps for Glass well and truly, Glass and Class Explorers, well and truly.
Well, I'd just like to hark back to the transparency, privacy question and say that there isn't any problem with having everybody know everything, except that there are people out there that want to use that knowledge against other people.
For ill will, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that abuse of the power that it gives you is why it's so scary. If it didn't matter, if everybody knew everything about you, I mean, the problem is the power that that gives over you.
It's a very good thought, and a classic example of one that came that actually chilled me as a chilling effect was, I did a presentation with 145 police officers in another state in Australia last year, and on the table I brought forward a technology that people didn't know about. I stood it up on the table, and it's a Barbie doll produced by Mattel. It was banned by the FBI the year before. The Barbie doll's got a camera in its gut, and it's got a plug in its backside. And Mattel encouraged kids to play with this camera-driven Barbie doll and then upload the data into the Mattel servers. And, of course, you can imagine who was trying to find out who was going into the Mattel servers. And in the same workshop, an officer... Oh, I got into this privacy, transparency sort of conversation. He said, Alex, look, seriously, if we were to unearth every keystroke and everything they looked at on the internet from the beginning of their time of looking on the internet, we would have to jail 70% of the population. And I said, that's an interesting figure. It's an interesting figure. He said, let me tell you also about the traffic that occurs post 8 p.m. at night to 2 p.m. in the morning. I said, look, I just don't need to go any further with talking about, you know, where people's, you know, that is part of a reality of the world. So unearthing people, I think in actual fact a lot of people don't act in privacy or transparency, they act in a state of obscurity. They're trying hard to obscure stuff. They're creating alternate aliases. They're trying to protect, you know, their their fetishes or their desires or their fears or their hopes or dreams in other ways. And that's normal humanity. That's what humanity does. For us to say, or even to ask the question, I felt it was rather audacious to say, what does the term privacy mean to you, or privacy? It's very inflammatory. Because for most people, they say it's what it means to me. It's not what it means to you or to anyone else. It's actually what it means to me, which differs. So it was a tricky question anyway. It was one of 10 I asked.
There's probably a good outlet where people can, you know, do what they want to do and not be judged criminally for it, as long as they're not bothering other people. But, you know, I just read a book called Hackers on Steroids, which is something came free on Kindle, but my wife downloaded it, and there are some pretty nasty people out there. who were trolls who were trolling, you know, I think this one was about people who were hacking into pages of kids who had died and things like that. And some of these people are being brought to court, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Facebook allows people to make profiles that aren't, it doesn't take down profiles that aren't actually backed by identity, so people can just go in and create new profiles and things like that. So there are issues like that. Why does Facebook allow that if that really is causing a problem? And apparently it is. Yeah. And you can just go on
changing. It's gradually changing those conditions to, you have to be identified by a mobile phone on a different IP address if you log in against a certain page and so on. But I think in the context of the discussion around wearable technology, I mean, glass is really just one of many, many, many different types of wearable technologies. What I'm really interested in, it's part of a paper that I'm writing or presenting at Ascolyte coming up in Dunedin and New Zealand, is around the nature of data. I find the conversation around data far more interesting than talking about really about privacy or, you know, fears around something that looks like you're a cyborg. I mean, it's no more cyborgish looking to me than somebody holding a massive brick phone up to their head in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You can remember those big brick phones. They were so heavy you could hardly, what were they? 1.7 kilos or something? Mm-hmm. The current Google Glass is the brick phone for the head. So its profile and its form factor is going to exponentially collapse down to a very, very thin, trendy looking clip that fits on the side of your glasses and does much the same thing. So the data, though, where does the data go? How does the data flow? Mm-hmm. And how can we harness that and use that for an educational and training organizational environment is of great interest to me. And I'm involved in a project that's looking at hacking Alzheimer's, which is how can we facilitate total recall for an individual who has cognitive impairment, using life logging cameras, which are body worn on the chest or on a clip, that is then Wi-Fi'd back into a server that then provides short snippets of parts of the day. That individual can recall those parts of the day wearing something like glass. So there is
a person, say, with Alzheimer's.
Yes, that's right. Somebody with dementia, in various states of dementia, so they can have components or parts of their day replayed for them in context from their perspective, not being the subject of the camera, mm-hmm. but from what they saw. And I think that's the key. That's the key. If you can provide somebody with cognitive impairment with snippets of certain components of the day, our brain is so well developed to obliterate most of what we see and feel and do. But if that person can replay a few of those, it might trigger cognitive rewiring of the brain in certain ways. It may not. We don't know.
But it will at least remind a person that can actually see the video of what went on. Is, I think that's Andy Kropa's project. And he said his interview that, you know, the caregiver can go over it with the person.
From their perspective, not from
something subject. Has joined us. He's like, Okay. She's in Uzbekistan. She's a fan and a loyal follower, and excellent. We appreciate that. So welcome, Halima. One thing that brick, and whether it's a brick or whether it's something, well, one point that a lot of your interviewees made was that there's nothing surreptitious about this device, because although it can be jailbroken, it indicates when it's filming, and you can also lift it up, apparently, people are just having a little bit of trouble getting to grips with the fact that it's new, but in fact, it's actually, there's not a lot that you could abuse on Google Glass that you can't abuse on an existing technology. So people are not really at the stage where they're saying, oh, Google Glass, oh yeah, we've seen that before. You know, they're concerned about this new technology that they don't understand. And also, apparently, people, when they put them on, their fears, that's another threat that came through the interviews. Once they let people try them out, those fears evaporated. People could see, oh yeah, I can use this.
But I think the thing is, Vance, we're amongst tonight we're part of a very broadly ranged, widely cultured, well-learned group of people. Now, I can guarantee you that the fears that have been espoused and answered per se are those that come with the script. You know, there's a script that says to go to the bathroom, put your glass on the top of your head so no one will appear to be, you know, disturbed by that. The second one is, does the camera always turn on and is it always on? So the answer is no. I think in actual fact, if we take the glass off the person and we take them aside and we talk to them about the engineering of glass, and the real fears that people would ask them the questions, they wouldn't have an answer for. And the real fears are around auto backup. Where does my data go? Things around, okay, so if this is a normalization of the technology, and what are the next versions of this actually going to incorporate that take those controls away? Facial recognition app has been turned off, which means that it's already developed and already working. The use to triangulate people and to cyber bully people en masse has certain preclusions where it does certain things and won't work. But what happens when people can make these things do what they need to do? And if someone is able to look at you, listen to you, and also start to gain information about you without you telling them, in proximity, does that alter the way that we then relate to people at eye line level? You know, our affinity is broken if that person is constantly engaging with a network that's elsewhere. So what does it mean to change our humanity in that regard? So
I think that's very, very scary.
Police officer who stopped you, for example.
That's a very minor. He was wearing a Taser.com Axon Flex camera, which was on trial in Australia. There's now 500 cops in the UK wearing them permanently on beat. And guess where all the data goes? It doesn't go into the UK servers. It goes into evidence.com, which is in the US. But, you know, we have to think about, we've really got to think beyond the tacit questions that we would ask. Is the camera always on? Don't ask the question. Assume it is. I mean, are you taking a picture of me? Don't ask the question. Just assume it is. So why would we put a demarcation and make the other person feel uncomfortable if they're wearing a device they think is not on? How do they know? How are they going to know? I mean, yes, it glows when it's on, but I know fine well that if you have a look at some of the technologies coming up, they are neuroscience-controlled glass. I put a picture of one up recently. It's a 3-year-old project. Go to personalneuro.com and have a look. It's an axon. It's a neural axon band around the back, and it's got a little thing that sits over the brain. You can just think, and it takes a photo. I'm not being stupid.
takes this a photo of what?
It's a, anything you want.
Oh, okay. So it's
and it will take the photo. So it's around. That's where that's where the technology is heading. What we're getting in our class and what's going to happen soon within the next couple of years are technologies that are fairly dumbed down. But the successive prototypes that have passed that are almost a decade old. You know what I mean? Like what they're introducing out are very, very dumbed down devices for a reason. Because humanity is not ready for transparency yet. We're not ready for that yet. We're still struggling with our last points of, no, the classroom is not a place where we should be have cameras in all the time, even though we've got cameras in the roofs, surveillance cameras, they keep us safe. Now putting cameras on people, that changes the equation somewhat. When we take the camera off the roof and put it on a person, and I don't really know if it's on or off, I just assume it is, I'm going to start to think that that person's going to be my safety shield. And that's what's happened with the assaults with people with glass. It's already starting. There are people that are being physically attacked in physical environments, and not only physically, but more importantly, verbally and repeatedly, for wearing what is known as and identified as a large corporation's device type. So how do we prepare for, as somebody said earlier, does this make us thus the this and them, or us and them? Is this going to socially sort the haves and have-nots?
If they weren't already socially sorted.
Yes, that's right. So is this going to be a new... Is this another digital divide that we had not envisaged would be as...
I think that this technology is just taking it a step or several steps further, making things more ubiquitous. And let's say, you know, we've always been exposed to what people who are listening to us, for example, in class and so on, they can go outside, they can go home and say, oh, the teacher said this, and when the teacher did not say that kind of thing, you know. So they are misinterpreting, let's say, something the teacher said. I remember having a colleague in school who lived nearby, and every time we came back from school, I would sometimes, you know, give her a lift and talk to her about school, about the department, about the board, and I knew that she was going to give information. I didn't like the board, okay, should be said here. I knew that she was going to give information to the board, and sometimes I did it on purpose, you know. But this is a very minute thing at a very minute level, let's say, and all of these technologies are making things that have that are already happening. They are taking it to a different level, a much wider and ubiquitous level, I think. And it's kind of scary. I think I always remember Big Brother is watching you, right? That kind of thing. But I also think that if, you know, we want to speak our mind, and if we're not afraid of what we have to say and so on or do, then just go ahead, you know. And I agree with you, Alex. We should admit that people are recording, for example, right? If they're wearing glass, they can be recording us. We don't have to ask, are you doing this or that? Because I would not avoid saying something if I thought it was right, you know, just because people are filming it. I know that they can be badly used and so on in the future. Things can be changed. But anyway, sorry, went on too long.
That goes back to the problem of people in power who abuse their power. It's fine for you to say whatever you want, but it depends on what kind of government you're living under, for example. I'm reading The Burglary now, which is the exposure of J. Edgar Hoover's secret FBI. You know, if you're living in that kind of a situation where people are going to get back at you for what you said, I mean, the advantage with Google Glass is that at least you're going to be murdered for what you actually said, as opposed to being murdered for what somebody lied about you. You know, they accuse you of saying something. At least this way, you would be dying for what you actually said.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, maybe not dying, but being persecuted or being discriminated against or whatever. But that's the scary thing for me. And I just wanted to interject here that the facial recognition part is exciting because of the applications for people with prosopagnosia who are unable to recognize faces on their own.
Yeah.
So those kinds of uses are great, but you know, out there in the world, it just really scares me because I don't trust people with too much information not to make bad use of it. I'm sorry, maybe I'm just too old and jaded.
It's interesting because most of the people I interviewed said they trust inherently other peoples and groups. They just don't trust their government. And I think that's very different.
Yeah, it's
very
the different than what it was. Made up of people. J. Edgar Hoover was a person.
Of course,
maniacal, paranoid, power-hungry person.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think the fears that people espouse now are very similar to the same things that occurred when I started investigating how to use SMS technologies with young people back in 2002. You know, I still have some fantastic signs that, you know, I'm seeing it happen all over again. Oh, the very first thing we need to do is create a set of rules. Then we need to create a set of etiquette things. Then we're going to have to, then with the little kids, we're going to sit there and we're going to create these rules and create signs and we'll put them up on the wall and we'll all agree to them and we'll all, you know, it's like, wow, we haven't learned. We're just going to repeat the same thing all over again. Like, come on, you're teachers, you're learned people, you're scholars, what's going on? You know, like, can't you see the repeat of what you're doing?
I think it's basic human resistance to innovation, and then once you start taking it for granted, then it's, you know, it's okay. Once everybody starts using it or doing it or whatever, it's kind of okay.
Yeah, My supervisor talks about the pacification of normalization, or also the access to axis, meaning depending on how you look at the equation, depending on how you look at the data, depending on how it sits for your context, for your personal context, it's less jarring the more that you see it. Mm. So I must admit, when I first saw somebody wearing glass, which was Thad Starner, who invented glass, I thought, what a ridiculous-looking device. You know? And then, being in a facility with 32 people wearing that and wandering around and doing it, after a period of time, unless I was talking to them right up face-to-face, I completely forgot they had it on. And that's apparently people that are part of the Glass Explorer program, have been part of it for a year or so. They said, I've said to a couple of them, look, you live in a little isolated town that's 3.5 hours from New York City. Does anybody else wear glass in your town? And he said, no. I said, does it feel odd? You know, like going shopping and down to the pub or the bar or... No. What's it like going to school with it on? No, nobody says anything. So apparently people it just blends in. So you know, people just think it's some form of medical device the person has to wear. So,
right.
It's going to slip into society, and it's going to fundamentally, I think, shape and change the way that we interact with each other on an affinity eye-to-eye level. And I think more importantly, it's going to empower us in a networked way, in a way that we don't know anything about at the moment, and I'm only interested in the middle ground, in the middle way, how do we find a way through that in a way that's going to protect those people who are vulnerable, people who haven't learnt how to be a teenager yet, or people who haven't understood certain things they've been recorded and it's been transmitted even before they had an opportunity to retract it. And as Stephen Downes said, video lies. Video only gives the context from what we are viewing and seeing. It doesn't give all the other views unless we have those other views apparently there. So we've got to be very careful about how we assume something from watching a through-glass video.
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. If you go to Google and look at, just put hashtag through-glass together, all one word, lowercase, that is the most profound view that you'll see of how people are using glass. I'll just put it in the chat there. And Noam Chomsky says, you know, it's quite likely to destroy humanity. It's a very dumb thing to do.
Mm.
That's his point of view.
Mm.
And well, why did he say that? As that came up in one of the interviews.
It did, yeah. He admittedly said, he hasn't worn one or seen one or taken one apart, but he said it was a couple of interviews he's done. He said it's likely to destroy humanity. It's part of Eric Schmidt's dream to collect everything from everyone. And it's just actually a dumb, very dumb thing to do. It's going to destroy humanity. That was his statement, wasn't it?
You've mentioned in some of the chats that you don't have glass because you can't get it in Australia. No. Is that the... Yeah.
No. I can get it. Mm-hmm. I could have had it a year ago. I could be wearing it now and looking at you, and in actual fact, you would be seeing yourselves through me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
The interesting idea is you have to have a mirror so you can take a normal view. When you're talking to people on glass, you have to put up a mirror so that they can see you the way they're.
The way you see them.
Well, it gets crazy because if everybody's wearing glass, but everybody's. I mean, it's like Alice in Wonderland. You can't wrap your mind around it.
I think that's the point.
It's an infinite loop, and it actually will implode on itself. It's like having
Why would I want to be looking at myself? I want to be looking at the person I'm talking to.
Yeah, but it's funny, though, if you think about it, and I was having a discussion about it today with somebody who is an intelligence analyst, and his job is to count body counts from drone hits. So he operates, he himself, during the day, is actually a camera in a plane over an area. So he is the camera all day. And when he comes home, you know, we got to chatting about glass. He said, it's just ridiculous. It means that humanity will not be seeing itself anymore because we actually live our lives by being subject to the camera. We don't live our lives by being the camera. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was a really interesting way that he put it, much like you've just put it there.
Uh-huh.
It's going to change the way that we view our lives. So I'm writing a paper with a couple of other people called Through Glass: Subjectivity, Objectivity, and Social Transparency. And it's really the same. It's like it's on that sort of theme. That if I was wearing glass, you would only be seeing what I'm looking at. And likewise, if you're wearing glass, all you would be seeing is what you'd be looking at. And it doesn't make a very good hangout. In actual fact, it's very strange. And every time I've ever had a hangout with Steve Mann. I'm looking through him. I'm very rarely looking at him. It's very disconcerting. I just don't know how to... I feel like I am him, and I'm looking through him and talking as him to him. It's very schizophrenic.
I don't see the advantage.
He did come to one of our hangouts where you got him there. I think it was...
Yeah.
Maybe you were in Toronto, and he was wearing glass, but we were looking at him.
Yeah, he was wearing pivot heads, I think, at the time. He wasn't wearing his normal eye glass, which is the very first glass, digital glass side of things. The other thing is I choose not to wear glass, and I'm going to choose to not wear glass for as long as I possibly can. And I think it's important in the context of my PhD to try not to wear glass for as long as I can. I'm definitely... Definitely. It's proximity to development with people that wear glass and so on, but I choose at this point in time not to enter into that space yet.
Hello.
Now, if someone wanted to,
Hi there.
How would they go about it?
Hello, Ben.
Hi, Halima.
Hello there.
I see that there are people of not only on one generation. Maybe I am 70 years old, and I see people aged here too. And I think that aged people understand how to use, apply these sophisticated ICT tools. I was surprised by Teresa's speaking about only one computer using. It was so good because many Western specialists even laugh at us if they see in webinars only one computer and 10 people speaking at one computer. Aged people understand how to make very good necessary things to do educational needs, also using this sophisticated tool. And I would thank you for inviting me to this interesting conference. Vance, I think that we must focus more on educational needs. Not only demonstrate new IC tools, but speak about them, how they use, how can they use it in educational context, not only in your countries, in very rich countries, but many in developing countries, even in countries like Uzbekistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Halima.
Thank you.
Alex.
Very good.
I was wondering if you're writing that paper with other colleagues, right, and friends, about through glass and not wearing them, do you have people in the group who wear them, others don't wear them, or are you the only one not wearing them? And does that influence the kind of perspective you have? I guess it should, right?
It does, but I'm prepared to hang myself. I'm prepared to hang myself on the point that I don't. I think that it's important to be able to sit in the company of people that do, that are enamored by the technology, and also people who are very technically proficient, such as Professor Mark Billinghurst, who is one of the original engineers of glass, and to critically analyze how he differentiates between... He's developing whole courses for his higher education university in the Canterbury University of Canterbury for glass alone, just for one particular type of technology. HCI, the human-computing interaction. So I think it is important to be able to, in some way, be a bridge for the conversation. To not lose myself on. I understand what it does. I've been wearing point of view video technology for a long period of time. I just haven't taken the next step to network technology, and I have profound fears around where the data is going, how I can access and use the data, who gets access to that data and what they're doing with it, for what reason. I need to better understand all of that before I would say, yep, that seems like a very sensible thing now to wear it. So I'm going to continue to keep exploring critically alongside those and include the views of those who are wearing it. And I'm actually looking at, I'm actually examining what they are pointing and shooting through glass. So when I say to somebody like Kimberly, Kimberly, I understand that little window that's in the view when you shoot a photo through glass. It's called a vignette. Can you tell me what physical actions you're making in order for the vignette to appear and do that? She said, well, it takes probably 2 to 3 different physical actions to actually make that little photo appear within through glass. So I said, well, that's quite intentful, isn't it? You're intentfully putting something. And she said, oh, yeah, but not all the time. I've actually got another app that's called Word of the Day. And I said, what does that do, Kimberly? She said, well, when I'm walking along, I concentrate on something for a minute. So I'm looking at my dog, and all of a sudden this word will pop up. And it looks like a word that's come out of Wikipedia. And it might say semiotic. And it's got the little explanation as to what semiotic means. And I go, should I actually vignette this or not? Yeah, that looks good. Click. And there you go. So there's this juxtaposition between what she was seeing, what she inherently was given randomly, supposedly randomly, and also where this randomness occurs within a geospatial context. So she might be in the city looking at her dog, but if she was in the country looking at a horse, she'd be given a different word to look at. So all these, if I was wearing glass myself, I'd be enamored with just testing it. I'm a lush person. I'd be taking a zillion photos. There'd be no point in these interviews any further. I'd be gone. Uh-huh. I'm trying to just keep one step purposely back, but at the same time, I'm involved in 17 different projects that are developing for glass, looking at all sorts of use cases: physiology, police, educate. I mean, we've got one project there with hairdressers. Mm. Oh, God. It's unbelievable. Unbelievably how amazing the stuff is that goes on with a bunch of hairdressers wearing glass. Incredible stuff. And they're creating the most amazing high-resolution, short, gossip-filled videos and resources for their students that are hilarious. They're so engaging. And they can just transmit them directly to the student, It's like, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we've been dreaming of forever, So
you
that's
make
the
me
middle
think,
ground. Yeah.
You make me think of people with schizophrenia who tell them that voices in their head tell them to do terrible things. Now we're saying that there actually could be voices in our heads that even if we do not have mental illness. I mean, semiotic is pretty benign, but you could transmit, kill
easy.
Or lie.
It's not far away from where another part of what I'm looking at is the fact that the bone conducting microphone is exactly that. It picks up. Think of this. The window is the eye to the soul, isn't it? So the iris gives away so much information. If you're anxious, your iris responds to certain things. If that's being mapped in conjunction with those intonations in your breath, those sighs, those very minute personal sounds, if they're being heard by that microphone in conjunction with the iris view, it knows where you are physically in somewhere else. Yes, it's very possible for the sounds to be transmitted back from the machine into there. That's very, very possible. Mm. And I've questioned one of the interviews there, if you ever get to it, was probably the most contentious when I asked a question. I said, well, what would have happened if you'd been in the crowd at the Boston bombings at the time when everything went off? Would the evidence be any better or worse? They said it probably wouldn't be any better because they identified them by CCTV cameras, not from phone cameras at the time, which was a great answer. And I said to them, like much later on, weeks later, they came back to me, I won't say who it was, and said, in actual fact, I've been thinking about that quite a lot. It would have been possible to turn on the 600 or so Google Glass wearers at the time all at once. I said, yes, that's the true fear of some people. And it's been espoused, and I've put some articles up tonight in my G+ thread about that. There is quite a growing concern from people that the device type itself is not, you don't buy it, you can't buy it. You actually lease it. Hmm. If you go to the terms of service for glass, have a close look in the fine print, the device can be at any time rendered inoperable remotely. If a device that you buy can be rendered inoperable just automatically from their control, you're not buying it, you're leasing it.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case en masse, then they can also inversely turn it on when they want. Right. There is no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's absolutely no doubt about it. If it's a military context, this is where the technology came from. We all know that. We know that it was developed from militarial context, and it was developed from, the next step in was from pornography, and it goes down the trail until consumers get it, and we get it. So we're inheriting a dumbed-down, consumer-driven technology that is just taking us the next step forward, but there are many steps forward with the technology that will go forward. I mean, we're recording this discussion through Google's framework. It's listening to this and watching this later. People are. It's simple.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say I've got no fear in saying things like that, well, I've been talking with engineers and talking with sociologists and talking with real people in the community that's what they're saying. You can go and it's been recorded. You can go and see it. So I'm not shying away from the fact that I do think, yeah, I think on the, I think like, the funny thing is actually about all of this is that the 100 or so interviews I've done as part of my PhD, which will be published in late 2015, are with all of the engineers of all of this, are with the science fiction writers, are with the poets, are with those that conglomerate in the pub, in the at the bar, and dream the dreams. And the engineers put the dreams together. And the predominant statements from engineers are that privacy has no place in our workplace. We would not be able to build the stuff that we do if we had to worry about privacy. And that's what guides my perspective on how we need to consider this in an educational context. We need to consider that the device types were not designed with privacy in mind. They weren't. The mobile phone technology has had numerous restrictions on it to keep it the way it was. You know what I mean? It's so dumbed down. Yes, you can take a photo with it, but you've got to hold it up and operate it unless you've got a voice control to take it and then you've got to hack it. And it's quite hard to do. Whereas these technologies are on, you know, it's a different, just a different ballgame. I reckon it's a different ballgame.
Alex, very interesting. Thank you very much. I need to go because I have to back to real life and give and help my very aging parents, 95 and 88, with their lunch. Okay, so I will send you the Wi-Fi image. Talk to each other. Okay, as soon as I find it.
I put it in the chat, Terry.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Okay.
I was going to say you might be interested in Andy Kropa's Hacking Alzheimer's Google community, which is where he publishes a lot of the things, a conversation going around his projects with Alzheimer's, Hacking Alzheimer's.
Okay. Well, see you all. Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Bye, Tedda. You'll hear from me.
And nice meeting you, Alex. Okay, bye-bye.
Nice to meet you, too. Bye
for now. Thank you. Bye.
I want to be considerate of your time, Alex, because you're very considerate of your people who are on, but then on the other hand, you've been responding and carrying on the conversation. We really appreciate that. Dave has a question. Do you have time for one from him?
Thank you.
He did
come to
one of our
thank you for inviting.
Yeah, no problem at all.
Alexander, David. Thank you for a good presentation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Dosvidanya. It seems that the glass is a star in the sky, but I think that in the next time we will see it in reality too. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wow. Bye-bye.
That's a quote in this half. What did she just say? Glass?
Да, учите русский язык. Русский язык – это надо. You won't get Russian lectures in a Google Hangouts. I can organize for you extra Russian language courses. Yes.
Glass is a star in the sky, but in reality…
Если хотите знать русский язык, пожалуйста, напишите мне. Да. Okay.
Proximity. I'm just trying to remember what she said there. Glass is a star in the sky.
That's what I heard.
Я сказала, что glasses очки пока как звезда на небе. Glasses are like stars in the skies, but it's material. In reality, it's we will get it. Спасибо большое.
Fantastic! I love it. That's a fantastic quote. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I've got to coin that one. That's good.
Go ahead. Dave's wanted to ask a question for some time.
Do most people know who George Plimpton was?
Yeah.
No. Sounds familiar, but I don't know.
There was a wonderful, you know, produced more than 10 years ago piece on public broadcasting on Friday night about his life. And George Plimpton was a sort of a writer, but a professional amateur. So one season he went to Detroit and practiced with the Detroit Lions football team. He learned enough to be in a circus trapeze act. He pitched to Willie Mays and other famous baseball players. And, you know, his dream was to, you know, try things out in yeah. that he was every man experiencing what people, in a yeah. sense, weren't able to do themselves, either for physical reasons or for psychological reasons. And then as a journalist, he wrote about it because he could share the experiences of becoming a football player, a baseball player, you know, whatever yeah. he chose to do, but acknowledged at an amateur level that he wasn't a professional.
Yes. Yes. it describes almost entirely most of the people that I have interacted with over the last 4 or 5 months. It's also... It's also very apparent that there is a number of those that I did interview that, in a participatory journalist way, feel that they are contributing into a much bigger and deeper framework of social critique than they would have if they hadn't been equipped with this particular type of technology. And I found it fascinating talking with people who were professionals. Lawyers who felt that their lives had substantially shifted as a result of this particular type of technology. And it fascinates me that they had, up until that point in time, considered that their lives were very dull and meaningless. And yet, when they're a bit equipped with something that can rapidly produce and rapidly participate on a citizen journalist level, how profoundly different they are as people. One of them is the truck driver Rick Sayre, S-A-R-E. He's wearing glass in his cab as he's driving his truck, and he just decides there and then to create something and tell us about what he does and his work life and all the rest of it, and then just presses go and shares the experience as a truck driver driving his truck. And it's a profound video. It's incredible. There's nothing like it. I can't find anything like it anywhere. And I just said to him, you know, you've no idea, that 8 minutes gave me a view of not only your stature and what's in front of you, but also the way that you relate to the equipment, the road, and I thanked him in Google Chat, G+ chat, and I got back this sentence, this one long sentence with no punctuation, nothing. It was about 5 sentences in one. And then I realized he's actually talking to me through glass. He's actually still driving the truck. He's watched my chat come into his glass, and he's responded to me talking. He hasn't typed anything. And I thought, there you go. That's what's coming, is speech to text, text to speech, reality, like this real field stuff. And I'm sure if Plimpton was still alive, he would be astounded with how more broadly perhaps his audience would have been. I love the fact that Plimpton's work was really around that vernacular. You know, I that was my first PhD proposal I did in 2000. How can you use a 44-gallon drum to, you know, what's the implications of 44-gallon drums in tracking the way that we've colonized social space, you know, in a country? So it's really around experiential level journalism, and I think that's what this is going to. It's going to spawn a whole heap of creativity as well. I think in a fundamental way, we're going to see views into stuff that we've never seen before. I don't know if that's a good thing, though, in certain respects, but definitely, yeah, it's a big one.
and it's going to become something else. Though it's not going to be on your glass, it might be. And, there's going to be a next stage of point of view technology.
Yeah, David says that you're riding alongside him. I wish to correct that one. In actual fact, I have become him. This is the difference. This is what Stephen Mann has been pointing out for a long period of time. That we will become the person who is wearing that particular camera, because the field of view is as though we're looking through their eyes out at the world. And our meta filter is not strong enough to disconnect from the human that's wearing that in that perspective, whether it's an assault, whether it's an account, whether it's a vignette, whether it's we are going to become that, we're coming that. And I think that's one of the very first things when I went to Toronto that Steve said to me, just log into Glogger and get on with it. You know, share what you see. And I was like, yeah, I'm a bit reserved about that. I see some pretty awful stuff. He said, just share it. What have you got to fear? What are you worried about? Share everything. It's okay. Just share it.
If everybody shares everything, there's going to be nobody to look at anything anyway.
Yeah.
So everybody will be sharing, and nobody will be watching.
But it will create a different internet, won't it? Because currently the internet's created by 5% of the people that actually are on it.
And so, it's already like way too voluminous for anybody of us to deal with.
Look, I can guarantee you, I've only gone back and watched one or two videos of my own. So there you go. It's a classic case, isn't it? So we're going to be producing just huge amounts of data, which we hardly ever go back on and look at. But when we do want to, then we can. We can reuse it. It is possible to reuse it.
And we'll have to find some system for bringing it back to us systematically, I suppose.
To stick with my, you know, with my theme of abuse of power, people can go back in your life and extract something out of context, which can then be used against you, because the context is all. Anyway, I'm sorry to be so negative. I'm just an old lady.
No, I don't think you are being negative. I think it's important to be critical and to allow criticality to be voiced. I don't have a problem. I think when people are naysaying, the opposite is soothsaying. So it's perfectly fine to be able to say, well, look, you know, I think that police perhaps are going to be wearing this in the near future. It's not a negative thing. It's probably going to happen. It's not about the police that we're worried about. It's about how does the police deal with people that are wearing something shooting back on them? You know, how are they actually going to deal with the differential of always being on camera themselves? Or like the surgeon, like I've got a project on where, you know people in a resus where they have to resuscitate people on a gurney? And you've only got literally 12 seconds or 18 seconds to do something before they're dead. I mean, that device, whatever they're wearing, has to work. And these guys are testing glass in a resus room and saying, well, that machine over there is no longer useful and that one over there is no longer useful. I'm going, whoa, hang on a minute. You guys have just jumped from perception to product. There's somewhere in between that. There's got to be a user testing. You know, we've got to make colossal amounts of mistakes first before you go and apply it in a real-life setting. But they're very keen to just jump over the divide. Oof, bang, give us 10 of them. Let's get on with it. There's profound issues with that. It's not naysaying. It's just a critical framework, critical thinking. And believe me, in the last 5 years, I have copped everything. From people saying, Alex, I have no idea what you're doing, but it's got nothing to do with education. Human computing and wearable cameras are just not going to be in a class setting ever. And no, there's not going to be a corporation that runs nothing. It's not going to happen. Anyway, here we are, and the next part of the journey is going to be quite interesting. because I'm certainly not at the forefront of it at all. I find myself marginally behind the back foot for a lot of it, but I'm willing to listen to the people that are the prosumers. I'm willing to listen to the people who are the engineers, and listening to people from, you know, from criminal justice. I've interviewed a few people who are covert policing. I've interviewed pornographers. I've interviewed quite a number of people that other people wouldn't have even bothered listening to. But it gives you a fair view on where this sort of technology is going to have an impact. It's going to be quite profound.
One thing that I really like about Alex is that he comes back and updates us every now and then. And we've had him on several times. We've had these conversations. I'm sure this isn't going to be the last time we get to talk to him, and the next time you'll have a lot more to tell us, and we'll be sharing more. The next thing, wow, I can't wait. You know,
fireside chat.
Yeah, I don't want to impose on you too much. We've kept you up an hour and a half already.
Oh, that's fine. Well, I hope Vance that you'll also have the opportunity to bring in the educators that are using this technology in a meaningful and useful way, because at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters, I think, is this technology useful? And that's what's going to govern whether it's successful or not. If people that are very professional educators and technologists and so on are saying it's a useful technology, then we have to prepare ourselves for it now. We can't play catch up. We've got to get into the conversation. We've got to start. We've got to go down to the base camp for Google. You'll find them in your fair city in the States there. Go and buy them, $1,500, and check it out. I'm not selling it, but I'm saying it's the only way we're going to get an opportunity to. And Glass, Google, is only one provider. The Samsung Gear is coming out. There's the Mavaro. There's the M100. There's whole swag of them about to come out. Apple will bring one out for sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that was a question I asked earlier.
It'll be closed.
Well, under the rug, but yeah. It'll only work with an iPhone. But yeah. But that's, you know, what should we be doing? How should we, you know, do this? Go down and buy one. I think that's a good answer. You couldn't have said that probably a week or 2 weeks ago, because then it was only in the Google Explorer program. So
that's right. Yeah, it's an open beta. You can go and purchase it. Mm-hmm. We've got a number of units in the University Inspire Center, which is part of our lab area, prototyping and so on. But we've managed to acquire those under developer status through our military contacts mainly. So across Australasia, the Australian Law Reform Commission is trying to ban it outright, influencing it so that it is banned. It's not useful. And it's quite likely that many other organisations who have fears around its readiness, social readiness, will say no, it's not going to be happened, but it appears that it will. So we have to ready ourselves for that in some way.
It appears that it has.
Well, that's it. I mean, it basically has. Yeah. I mean, it's for some people they've gone past it. Kathy Schrock's like bored with it. You know, let's get on with the next thing. iPads in classrooms, glass in class. What's next?
Yeah. Okay, well,
that's what it sounds like to some people.
Yeah. Well, that set of interviews has really brought you in to meet the community of explorers and to demystify in some way glass. They help a lot to help us understand what it is. Andy even takes his off and shows it to you, you know, and so you can see exactly how it works. And so that's really helpful, and I really appreciate you doing all that work and coming online to tell us about it. That's very kind of you.
It's you're welcome. You're welcome. The articles I have in, or the few links I've put on the main chat there, Vance, they point to some of those answers that I can't give you, like all of the technical bits that are inside of glass. I don't know, it's so complex. There's so many sensors and cameras and stuff in it that the articles I've given show that. Yeah, my interviews are a step towards understanding the impact that it will have on in general, in a human context. And my explorations and my activity in a research capacity are around how it will apply in a scholarly context, but also in a commercial context, how it will be for medical practitioners, aged care, hairdressing, all of those, yeah.
And where did you put those links? Which chat?
They're in the main chat there.
The chat wing?
Chat wing, yeah.
I'll take all of the links in the chat wing, and I'll take the links in this sidebar here, and I'll just tease out the good ones, and put those in the... This all gets posted at learningtogether.net. So
great.
Right now it's in the wiki where we all plan it, then it goes over to learningtogether.net where it's archived, and that's where we will find it. Maybe, if not tonight, in the morning. Or, well, not in the morning, at work, in the afternoon.
Yeah. Vance, it's great to have a chat with you. I'm looking forward to not only where these things are heading, but where it fits in the context of everything else that we've ever done. And it just so happens to be a focus area of mine at the moment. But I'm working on a fair bit of stuff to do with drones in schools.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to introduce them to some of that stuff, but it's an odd situation, but in any event, that's really cool. So that should come useful at some point.
That's right, exactly. Yep, that's the next level of inquiry. That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Alrighty.
Trying to get some ideas now. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Alex. I really appreciate you.
Not at all. Thank you, Vance. I bid you farewell, my colleague and friend, and I will see you on another chat channel soon.
Yeah, okay. Cheers. Good night.
Bye for now.